The morning after the disastrous vote at Burnham Wood, Tony had awoken in his childhood bedroom with an idea for an article so fully formed in his mind that it was almost as though he'd written it already, in his sleep. The piece would be a searing indictment of the super rich. He would expose, remorselessly, those hypocrites and cynics who publicly deny the catastrophe of climate change, while secretly short-selling that very same position and hedging all their bets. The millionaires and billionaires who preach self-reliance while accepting vast handouts in the form of subsidies and easy credit, and who bemoaned red tape while building contractual fortresses to shield their capital from their ex-wives. The tax-dodging economic parasites who treated state treasuries like casinos and dismantled welfare programs out of spite, who secured immensely lucrative state contracts through illegitimate back channels and grubby, endlessly revolving doors, who eroded civil standards, who demolished social norms, and whose obscene fortunes had been made, in every case, on the back of institutions built with public funding, enriched by public patronage, and rightfully belonging to the public, most notably the fucking internet. The confirmed sociopaths who were literally vampiric with their regular transfusions of younger, healthier blood. The cancerous polluters who consumed more and burned more and wasted more than half the world's population put together. The crypto-fascist dirty tricksters who pretended to be populists while defrauding and despising the people, who lied with impunity, who stole with impunity, who murdered with impunity, who invented scapegoats, who incited suicides, who encouraged violence and provoked unrest, and who then retreated into a private sphere of luxury so well insulated from the lives of ordinary people and so well defended against them that it basically amounted to a form of secession. Robert Lemoyne was one of dozens, maybe hundreds of super-rich survivalists buying bolt holes in New Zealand for the end of days. Tony would investigate them all. So he told himself, as feeling more energetic than he had in months, he opened up his laptop and began to type. It wasn't until his animosity ran dry several thousand words later that he was able to admit the real spur to his ambition for the essay, which was that he was sitting on a scoop. The offer that Lemoyne had made to Mira was a proper story, the stuff of feature articles and documentary podcasts and international attention. It presented Tony with the opportunity of a lifetime, a chance to affirm his principles while also bagging the exclusive that would make his name. For who was better placed to write the thing, after all, than one of the founding members of Burnham Wood? The very member, in fact, who'd composed the principles of unity that Lemoyne's proposal so egregiously and shamelessly profaned. Tony sat back, feeling his guts clench with excitement. He could go undercover. He could drive down to Thorndyke and tell them that he'd changed his mind, that he was sorry, that he wanted in. He could report on the project from the inside. He could keep a journal, take photographs, conduct clandestine interviews perhaps, then stage a dawning disaffection to give the piece an arc. He shook his head. It would be too much of a betrayal. It would mean the end of his relationship with Mira, and maybe the end of Burnham Wood. But did he even have a relationship with Mira? And hadn't they betrayed themselves already? Hadn't they made their beds already? Hadn't they sold their souls already by joining forces with Lemoyne? No, Tony thought sternly, in a tone of remonstrance towards himself. He would draw the line at going undercover. These were his friends, at least they used to be, and he wouldn't openly deceive them. But it was a free country, and there was nothing to stop him from planning a little road trip down to Thorndyke, if the mood struck him. Just for a bit of camping, maybe. And if he saw something while he was down there, if he stumbled on something or heard something or discovered something, well, there would be nothing to stop him from investigating in the public interest and reporting, purely in the public interest, what he found. To have talked himself down from a more drastic course of action gave Tony a pleasing sense of his own judiciousness and clemency. And when he finally traipsed downstairs a little after 1 o'clock, ravenous and not yet showered, it was with the calm conviction of a man who had faced a moral test and chosen right.
"You were in Leighton last night,"
his mother said as he opened the refrigerator and peered in.
"Was it a good meeting?"
Tony's equanimity dissolved at once.
"No," he said curtly. "It was shit."
"Oh, But you were so looking forward to it, said Brenda Gallo, clapping her hand to her heart. What happened?
I wasn't looking forward to it that much, Tony said.
He unscrewed the cap on the milk bottle and sniffed. His sister Veronica was on her way into the kitchen.
Do you really have to sniff like that? She said, making a disgusted face.
I want to make sure that it's fresh.
Just look at the expiry date.
It's not always accurate.
It is when it's like a week away.
What's the big deal? Said Tony. I'm not breathing out. I'm not blowing my nose on it.
Brenda handed him a cereal bowl, anticipating his need for one.
Well, I'm sorry you had a bad time, she said.
Where? Said Veronica.
At Burnham Wood, said Brenda,
and Tony felt the odd twinge of dislocation he always got whenever he heard one of his parents speak the name of the group aloud.
He had a meeting.
When?
Said Veronica, frowning.
Last night. At that nice cafe that's owned by that nice girl. What's her name?
Can we stop talking about this, please?
Said Tony, taking his breakfast to the table.
Calendar, said his mother. Chelsea Calendar.
Amber,
Tony said through gritted teeth.
Yes, Amber, with the chin.
I'm really done talking about it, Tony said. Thanks.
Veronica had started to laugh.
You are so full of shit, she said to Tony. You are so unbelievably full of shit.
Veronica, said her mother approvingly.
Tony was scowling at her.
Why?
You weren't at Burnham Wood last night, she said. You were at the Fox and Ferret making out with Rosie DeMarnie.
What?
Cried Brenda, clapping her hand to her heart again.
You are so busted, said Veronica.
How the hell do you know that? Said Tony.
Hamish Locus saw you. He texted me and he was like, I'll give you three guesses who your brother is making out with at literally this exact moment.
Do you even know how much of a creep you are? Said Tony.
You went to the Fox and Ferret, said his mother.
Want to know who I guessed? Said Veronica.
No, said Tony. Please don't talk.
You told me you had a meeting, said Brenda.
I did have a meeting, said Tony, and it was shit. And I basically got expelled, so I went to the pub to have a drink, and I saw Rosie DeMarnie, and I guess I forgot I was living in Stasi fucking East Germany in fucking 1984.
Language, said Brenda. What do you mean, expelled?
Just forget about it.
Fiona Keane, said Veronica, number one.
Veronica, shut up, said Tony.
Daisy Willits?
Oh, no, said Brenda. I never liked that girl.
Please shut up, said Tony to Veronica.
She was grinning.
And Mira Bunting.
Will you shut the fuck up?
Tony exploded, pushing his chair back from the table.
You don't know what the fuck you're talking about, Veronica.
Language, said his mother. Tony!
I know, said Veronica, holding up both hands. I know. That's what I'm saying. I couldn't guess.
Why were you even trying to guess? Tony said. What's wrong with you? Are you that sad and desperate, texting fucking Hamish Locus? Jesus Christ!
Tony!
Why are you embarrassed? Said Veronica. Rosie's great.
I'm not embarrassed, said Tony. I'm creeped out.
What do you mean, expelled? Said Brenda again.
I said I didn't want to talk about it, Tony said.
He picked up his cereal bowl.
And Mira hates my guts, by the way, so thanks.
Why?
Said Veronica.
What happened? Said his mother. Tony!
But he had already slammed the door. As he ate cross-legged on his unmade bed, he recalled a conversation that he'd had with Mira in the early days of Burnham Wood. They'd been debating the ethics of wealth redistribution, and Mira told him about an old custom in her father's family, where, if ever there was a piece of cake or a biscuit to be shared between two children, the rule was that one child would get to cut it, and the other child would get to choose. The child with the knife always tried to cut as evenly as possible, to avoid getting stuck with a much smaller portion. And Mira had suggested that this might be a rather good method for ensuring fairness in other contexts too. In designing a national budget, say,
What if those who determined where a country's tax revenues came from were from an entirely different political party from those who decided how to spend them? A small government conservative might feel differently about lowering taxes, and a big society liberal might feel differently about raising them, if the pot was then handed to the other side to divvy up. And a display of moderation from one party might go a long way to fostering goodwill and compromise in the other. The parties could even switch back and forth, Mira had said, her eyes sparking, to prevent either side from becoming complacent or from calcifying in their respective roles. It could work. Tony had rebuffed her. What she was describing, he told her, was essentially just a variation on Rawls, the arch-liberal arch-enemy of the actually authentic left. Didn't she call herself a radical? Because he was surprised, and frankly a little disappointed, that she saw any attraction at all in such a moderate and, let's face it, out-of-date position. But to his astonishment, Mira hadn't been at all chastised. She'd shot back that anyone could drop a name. But this idea was hers. She'd come up with it on her own, having never heard of Rawls and having never felt she needed to. How could an original idea be out of date? That was a contradiction in terms, a category error. And as for being moderate, sure, he meant it as an insult. But didn't the entire project of left-wing politics depend on people being willing, at some level, to share? And wasn't sharing basically just moderation by another name? And anyway, between the two of them, wasn't he the one who was more guilty of propping up the status quo by shooting her ideas down and dropping names of dead philosophers, as if that was in any way a legitimate response to anything anymore? And why was it that people on the left were always talking about who was actually on the left? Wasn't that kind of out of date? And if it wasn't, then maybe it should be, because it was pretty bloody off-putting to be treated like a double dealer all the time. Tony had been slightly dazed by the force of these counter-arguments, and had taken refuge in a lengthy explanation. He could still see in his mind's eye the way she'd listened, scowling slightly, looking at each of his eyes, and then at his mouth, and then at his eyes again, as he described the concept of the veil of ignorance to her. And then, when he was done, he could still see her grinning at him, and shaking her head and saying no, that he was wrong, that there was no comparison with Rawls at all, because her idea was so much better. Tony wondered why he hadn't kissed her right then, sitting in the box window of the library stairwell, he cross-legged, as he was now, she with her knees drawn up to her chest. He could still see her forearms resting on her knees, hands cupping elbows, close enough to touch. Her brown leather lace-ups, her bobby socks, the rolled-up hem of her jeans. Why hadn't he kissed her? Why hadn't he slipped his hand around her ankle or reached out to stroke her forearm or, most daringly, tucked a strand of her hair behind her ear? Why hadn't he just leaned in and kissed her as he'd so desperately wanted to, as he'd imagined doing ever since? He'd kissed Rosie DiMani. It was easy. It was almost unnerving how easy it had been. I really want to kiss you, he'd said, and she'd smiled and said, do it then. And so he had. Tony imagined Mira saying, do it then. He imagined leaning in across the window seat, imagined spreading his hand on the small of her back and pulling her towards him. Do it then, said Mira in his mind. And Tony drank the last of the milk out of the bowl, set it down on his bedside table, and stood up. In all the days and weeks that had passed since Tony's evening with Shelley at the bar, it had never occurred to him to wonder if she'd relayed to Mira the news that he'd come home. He was certain that they told each other everything. He had first-hand proof on that point, after all. And as he'd waited every day for Mira's call, becoming more and more depressed and more despairing, he told himself firmly and repeatedly that the ball was in her court. For if she felt any unease at all about the circumstances under which they'd slept together, and he'd racked his memory, he was positive that she'd been the instigator, that he'd done nothing dishonorable, that it had been her decision, that she'd come on to him. He was determined not to make the situation any worse by hounding her. When 3 weeks passed and Mira hadn't called, he'd had to conclude that she was sending him a message. And while he'd known he ought to let the matter drop, he'd also known that he couldn't rest until he'd seen her. He'd been debating showing up at the Hui alone and unannounced, when he'd seen that Finn Koford Nielsen had RSVP'd on Shelley's email chain, and on a sudden impulse he'd called him up to invite him for a beer beforehand. He'd intended,
It seemed so stupid now, to make it seem as though one thing had simply led to another. Since he'd been out with Fink already, he'd imagined telling Mira with a shrug. He'd figured what the hell. For old time's sake, he'd tag along. It had been a bad idea. Finn had been plainly baffled by the invitation, since he and Tony had never been that close. And Tony had been too nervous and distracted to care about trying to make the conversation flow. They had passed a stilted hour together, and he'd arrived at the hooey already irritated and defensive, his stomach sour from 2 pints of beer, only to find that Mira wasn't even there. He had taken her lateness, irrationally, as a further sign of her cold feelings toward him. And although it hadn't escaped his notice that she had been patently astonished to see him when she'd finally arrived, he'd been so worked up by that point that he'd interpreted her shock as mere amazement that he'd had the temerity to show his face at Burnham Wood at all. Even now, he had no doubt that she and Shelley were united. Shelley could have hardly acted faster to cast her vote in Mira's favour, and he'd caught the look of sympathy and gratitude that had passed between them afterwards, which she'd experienced almost as a personal rebuke. He'd left the hooey feeling comprehensively humiliated. And when Rosie DeMarnie tapped him on the shoulder in the queue to the bar at the Fox and Ferret an hour later, he'd actually groaned. He was really sorry, he'd told her, but seriously, all he wanted was to have a drink alone. It was a bit depressing, Tony thought now, to realize that he'd never had more luck, romantically speaking, than when he'd felt that he had hit rock bottom. He was never more attractive, apparently, than when he knew that he had nothing whatsoever left to lose. There was a knock on his bedroom door as he was crossing to it, and he opened to find Veronica holding out a mug of coffee. "Sorry," she said. "I was just giving you shit." Tony was touched. "Thanks," he said, taking the mug. "Mom said you were really looking forward to the meeting."
"You can't say meeting here anymore," Tony said darkly. "You have to say hooey."
"Is that why you got thrown out?" He exhaled and shook his head.
"Nah, just people being dicks."
"People meaning Mira?"
"Ugh," said Tony, lifting his shoulders to his ears. "Doesn't matter. It was dumb."
"How can they throw you out anyway?" said Veronica. "Isn't that, like, against the whole—"
"Exactly," said Tony.
"I mean, did nobody point that out?"
"Clearly you should have been there."
"Clearly." She shook her head in mock dismay and turned to go.
"Hey, Veronica," he said suddenly.
"Yeah," she said, her hand on the banister.
"Can I borrow your car to drive to Thorndyke?"
"Thorndyke," she said. "Why?" Some instinct told him not to mention the connection between Lemoyne and Burnham Wood. Instead, he told her that he was working on a piece of long-form investigative journalism and wanted to pursue a lead. The piece was about super-rich survivalists, he said, and he'd recently learned about somebody in Thorndyke who might be of value to him as a source. Veronica was much more impressed by this than he'd expected, and said immediately that of course he could borrow her car, for as long as he wanted it. She hardly ever drove it anyway. They arranged that he would leave that coming Friday. And after he had drunk the coffee, done his daily push-ups, showered and dressed, Tony sat down again at his laptop with restored confidence and energy. He began bookmarking articles and laying out parameters for his research. And when Rosie DeMarnie texted him a few hours later, saying how much fun she'd had last night, he texted back to say, sincerely, that it was the best thing that had happened to him since coming home. He added that he'd love to see her again before he left for Thorndyke, and she replied with 3 emojis, a party hat, a jazz hands, and a blush. They went out to dinner on Thursday night. Like Veronica, Rosie seemed impressed when he described his general intentions for his essay. But Tony detected a little pause, a touch of incredulity, or pity maybe, when he admitted that the piece hadn't been commissioned, and that in all likelihood he wasn't getting paid. And even though she smiled and said warmly that she couldn't wait to read it as soon as it was done, he couldn't quite shake the sense that she had formed an opinion about him that she doubted she was going to have to change. The evening passed pleasantly enough. She was a solicitor in family law, played indoor netball, liked Marvel movies, loved Battlestar Galactica, and had recently holidayed in Vietnam. But when she expressed remorse that he was heading down to Thorndyke the next morning, it was such bad timing, she said. How long did he think that he'd be gone? He realized, with total guilty clarity, that it was simply never going to work between them. He pushed down the feeling, promising to keep in touch, and of course to let her know the moment he returned. They kissed again outside the restaurant, and he declined her offer of a lift by saying that he'd parked two streets away. He waved her off, his smile fading as her scarlet Ford Fiesta rounded the corner and disappeared from sight. And on the bus home, he put his forehead against the seat in front of him and stared down at the pebbled linoleum between his knees, until he could tell from the ambient noise around him that the bus was drawing close to the set of traffic lights that marked his last chance before his stop to ring the bell. Walking home past familiar high fences and familiar gated driveways and familiar large suburban houses set back from the road, he felt his phone buzz in his pocket. Thinking it was probably Rosie, he didn't check it until after he'd got back to his parents' house and gone to bed. But it wasn't Rosie. It was a notification that a new document had been added to the shared folder Burnham Wood by the user Shelley Noakes. Tony turned his bedside light back on. He sat up in bed, opened the file, and began to read. The file was headed Schedule, 1606 Cottaway Pass Road, and it comprised a roster of tasks to be completed, a planting program and crop inventory, a rolling budget, a wish list of supplies, and a hand-drawn map of the farm. Tony scrutinized it carefully. He could see an airstrip near the top of the property which was marked Keep Clear, but there was no reference to a bunker and no indication of a potential building site. And so, after downloading a copy of the file for his records, he opened his browser and called up the local council's database. Lemoyne would need resource consent to build, and if Tony was in luck, then the plans for the bunker might be accessible online. He wasted over an hour in fruitless navigation before he found any planning permission associated with 1606 Cottaway Pass Road. But it was only a subdivision permit, and it had been granted to Owen and Jill Darvish in November of the previous year. They must be the people who had sold Lemoyne the farm. Searching their names, Tony was directed to the glut of news articles about the recent knighthood, establishment incarnate, he thought cynically, and from there to the news of the partnership between Autonomo and Darvish Pest Control, which aroused his cynicism even further. He could not see how a tech giant like Autonomo could possibly benefit from such a small-time connection, and he severely doubted the conservationist credentials of any company whose brand name ended on the word control. He was certain that all signs pointed to a quid pro quo, and he scowled, as Mira had, to learn that the orange-fronted parakeet was, allegedly, Owen Darvish's favourite native bird. In fact, Tony discovered, the Autonomo project was unlikely to affect the fate of this critically endangered species in the slightest, since the project was set to launch in the North Island, and the orange-fronted parakeet, like Mira, he'd had to Google it, was found only in a few remaining valleys in the south, including, he read, the Cottaway Basin, which lay just behind the Darvishes, and now Lemoyne's, back fence. He opened another tab on his browser to try to find out when exactly the sale of the farm had taken place, and how much exactly Lemoyne had paid. But to his surprise, his search returned no results. The real estate listing for 1606 Cottaway Pass Road had been taken down, and he could find nothing that connected Robert Lemoyne with Thorndyke, or, for that matter, with Owen and Jill Darvish in any way. Coming back through the news articles about the knighthood, he noticed that although Owen Darvish had mentioned Autonomo several times in the interviews he had given to the press, he had never actually named Lemoyne. Tony was starting to feel excited. Mira had said that Lemoyne had bought the farm off radar, but if the sale wasn't public knowledge yet, then he was looking at yet another scoop. A particularly damning one, he thought, for the decorated Owen Darvish, knight companion of the New Zealand Order of Merit, who played the part of Mr. Fully Kiwi, Mr. 100% Pure, Mr. Yeah, Nah, She'll Be Right, with such aplomb. Tony called up the Land Records database and submitted a request to view the title certificate to the property, paying a $5 fee for the privilege. And when he finally turned off his light again a little after 2 a.m., the last thing that crossed his mind before he drifted off to sleep was a quotation that he'd heard someplace, whose attribution he'd forgotten. That only something that a person didn't want to see in print was news, and everything else was appetizing. He arrived in Thorndyke late the next day and parked in the long-term car park next to the visitor center, which was empty, save for one other car. He'd brought with him his reporter's notebook and a dictaphone, but before he made his presence known among the locals, he wanted to conduct a few days' observation of Burnham Wood, to learn their daily patterns and, if possible, to try to get a sense of Lemoyne's. Shelley's document hadn't mentioned the billionaire at all, and although Mira had said at the Hui that Lemoyne used the airstrip frequently, she'd seemed to suggest that the farm was his destination, not his point of departure, which would imply that he was living somewhere else. Despite exhaustive online searching, Tony hadn't managed to discover even the most basic details about Lemoyne's present circumstances. Clearly, the man was adept at shielding his information from public view. And the first task that Tony had set himself, having taken inspiration from Shelley's impressively well-ordered schedule, was to find out the tail number of his plane. With this, he could reconstruct Lemoyne's past movements using open sources, and possibly anticipate his future movements too. He opened the hatchback of Veronica's car and sat down on the rear bumper to change his sneakers for his tramping boots. He was stiff from the long drive, and he had the kind of dull headache where he could feel the backs of his eyeballs in their sockets and the sides of his brain against his temples. He needed to get moving, and as he laced his boots, he squinted up at the lowering cloud and reckoned that he just had time to make camp before nightfall. Camp was just his backpack and a bivy bag, but there were few things Tony enjoyed more than sleeping out alone under the stars, especially in winter, and even, he felt the first few drops on his shoulders, when it rained. He had done a bit of tramping in the Kotawai Ranges as an undergraduate, and he knew the area around Thorndike moderately well. His plan was to head into the national park on the track that led up to the Madrigal Hut, below the Madrigal Glacier, where he'd spent a night on a climbing expedition once before. The hut was a good 6-hour tramp south of the pass, but he remembered that for the first hour or so, the track traversed the ridge above the township, and he figured that if he left the trail before it reached the edge of the Kotawai Basin and cut west, then he could bushbash down the hill and approach the Darvish property from the rear. Although the national parkland there was mostly forested, above the tree line he could recollect wide open views over the township and across the lake. He was sure that he could gain a good vantage point over the farm from somewhere higher up the mountainside, and to that end, he'd stopped at an outdoor store on his drive south and purchased a pair of binoculars, amusing himself with the imagined cover story, should he need one, that he was a birder looking for the famous orange-fronted parakeet that he'd heard spoken of so glowingly in recent news. He shouldered his backpack and set off into the national park, feeling his headache dissipate as the track climbed sharply up out of the valley to meet the ridge. Sheets of grey cloud were gusting down from the pass, cutting off the view beneath him, and seeming to arrest the twilight as the colours leached from green and blue to shades of grey. It was now raining steadily, and by the time he came down off the ridge and began looking for a sheltered place among the trees to spread his bivy bag, he was soaked to the skin, and the light was almost gone. He could only guess at his precise location. Before he'd left the car park, he had measured the distance on the map between the visitor center and the farm's front gate, divided this by his average walking speed, and added an extra 20 minutes to ascend the hill. And if his calculations were more or less correct, then he was somewhere on the slope above the airstrip, north and a little east of where the road began to climb towards the pass. He continued down the mountain and presently came upon a slab of granite protruding from a mossy bank that offered some protection from the weather. As campsites went, he thought, he'd seen worse. He shucked off his backpack, shook out his bivy bag, and strapped his head torch over his balaclava. The last of the daylight faded into dark as he screwed his stove together and set a pan of water over the flame. And all at once he realized, blinking, that the rain had stopped. The noise that he could hear was the endless patter of water dripping off leaves and branches, and behind it, a distant roar that must be the wind in the valley behind him. It couldn't be a river or a waterfall, because he knew that there was nothing of the kind nearby. At Burnham Wood, they would have welcomed the rain. He imagined them spreading tarpaulins in the fields, weighting the middles and staking down the corners so the canvas wouldn't fly away. Perhaps setting out rainwater butts under drain pipes and fashioning catchments in runoff ditches beside the road, and then piling back into Mira's van, drenched and laughing, to drive back to the shearing shed where they'd set up their base of operations. He imagined them stringing a clothesline among the ancient wooden chutes to hang their wet jackets up to dry, and he conjured in his mind a lofted space beyond the chutes where, in a happy hubbub of cross-pollinating chatter, they would all gather round to help prepare the evening meal, chopping vegetables for curry and washing rice and rolling out chapatis with an empty wine bottle dusted with flour,
and someone would be strumming a guitar or reading out listener crossword clues or narrating the gist of some recent article that had done the rounds online. And someone would be making an inventory of their progress to date or delegating tasks for the coming day or labeling seed sets for planting. And someone would be knitting, and someone would be poking irrigation holes in the bottoms of empty yogurt pots with a heated needle. And from time to time, a snatch of melody from the guitar would cut through their conversation, and they would all sing along in unison for a phrase or two, and then dissolve into embarrassed laughter. For at Burnham Wood, such instances of unprompted and unaffected concord were always followed, Tony remembered, by a discomforting self-consciousness. For a moment, everybody feeling squeamishly, just a tiny bit like members of a cult. The water was boiling. He cut the flame and poured half the saucepan into a pouch of dehydrated rice and beans, which he sealed and set aside to stew. With the rest, he made tea, squeezing a ribbon of sweetened condensed milk over the tea bag and stirring it with the spoon end of his all-purpose silicone utensil until the milk had dissolved and the liquid was slick and faintly iridescent in the smoky blue light of his torch. The tea bag split open when he pressed it against the side of the pot to wring out the last of the flavor, and he was obliged to spend the next few minutes fishing out tea leaves, a task he found so enjoyably absorbing that he consciously stilled his body and slowed his breath in order to focus on it, willing himself to move only his wrist and then only his fingertips, as he chased the little specks of darkness around the toffee-colored surface of the liquid with the tip of his spoon. He ate his dinner out of the pouch, drank the tea, then peeled off his sodden clothes and exchanged them for a fleece and a pair of woolen leggings, rubbing his arms and legs vigorously to warm up. His phone was in a Ziploc bag at the bottom of his backpack, powered off. He doubted that he'd get a signal. But when he turned it on to check, he was surprised to see four bars of service. A text message was waiting from Rosie, asking if he had arrived okay and if he was having a good time. He typed out a bland reply, sent it off, and then turned off the phone again before she had a chance to respond. Feeling oddly a little disappointed that despite his intrepid circumstances, he still had ready access to the web. After brushing his teeth and spitting the foam into the undergrowth, he climbed into his bivy bag, turned off his head torch, and fussed for a minute with a spare jersey, which he folded and refolded and then tucked beneath his head as a pillow. It couldn't be later than 9, and after a couple of months living with his parents, he'd become practically nocturnal. But the dark was so total and the woodsy smell of the rain so cozy and confidential seeming that as soon as he'd stretched out in his sleeping bag and scooched to find a comfortable position on the forest floor, he fell asleep. The bush was alive with birdsong when he woke the next morning. He could hear bellbirds, fantails, grey warblers, and others whose calls he didn't know, chiming and trilling and cheeping and fluting and crying in a shifting, enveloping cloak of sound, magnified, he thought, by the heavy skies, which hung low and overcast over the treetops, filling the valley and shearing off the peaks on either side. He lay in his sleeping bag for almost 20 minutes, smiling at the canopy and savoring the sounds, before he got up and boiled another pot of water for his breakfast, an instant porridge mix, which again he ate directly from the pouch, and a cup of instant coffee with the rest of the hot water. He relieved himself behind the granite slab, brushed his teeth again, and then packed up his things, tying the arms of his jacket around his backpack to dry. The cloud was starting to lift as he set off down the hill to find a place where he could get his bearings. Soon he reached the base of a stony outcrop that seemed as if it might afford a view. He climbed up, and when he looked out across the valley, he saw at once that he'd overshot the farm. His heart sank. He was now well to the south of the barricade, almost at the site of the landslide, in fact, judging from the height and shape of the ranges around him. The valley had narrowed as it began to climb towards the pass. He must have walked faster than he'd thought the previous night, perhaps because of his headache and the encroaching twilight. Or maybe he'd overestimated the distance from the visitor center, which he'd measured by eye, using the scale at the bottom of the map and the side of his finger. Tony felt chilled by his mistake, and suddenly very much alone. He was foolish not to have shared his plans with anyone. Even his family didn't know exactly where he was. He'd told them Thorndike, but he hadn't mentioned that he was heading to the backcountry, and he hadn't specified how long he'd be away. It might be weeks before they'd miss him. At the very least, he should have filled out an intentious form at the visitor center so that search and rescue would know where to start looking for him in the event that he didn't return to the car. He thought about getting out his phone again to send a message to his mother, but the idea embarrassed him even more. Instead, chastened, he set off to the north again, now paying close attention to his surroundings and stepping with exaggerated care. He knew that it hadn't been exactly necessary to bivouac. He'd passed a perfectly serviceable Department of Conservation campsite on his way into town, and he could admit that his plan to bush bash down the hill had been possibly a touch extreme. Perhaps, he reflected now, he'd been trying to atone somehow for what had happened at the Hui, to prove to himself that he was not just yet another Marxist intellectual cliché, not just yet another armchair critic with soft hands and smug opinions, who theorized about the working class while never having done a day of drudge work in his life. Tony was very proud to be well-read, and had often railed against the defensive anti-intellectualism that defined his country's culture. But he had nevertheless recognized in himself, at times, a deep desire to perform a kind of excessive, rugged practicality in compensation for his bookishness, submitting himself to physical privations, testing his strength and his endurance well beyond what was called for, and devising circuitous homemade solutions to problems that could be solved much more easily, and often more cheaply, by paying someone else to fix them. It hadn't been until he'd gone abroad that he'd been able to identify this trait as itself peculiarly Kiwi, reflecting a broader attitude held among his countrymen that to do a thing with effort was always more respectable than to have it done with ease. Inconvenience in New Zealand tended to be treated as a test of character, such that it was a point of national pride to be able to withstand discomfort or poor service without giving in to the temptation to complain. Tony had never considered himself to be particularly patriotic. He did not accept, in fact, that there was any material difference between the patriot and the nationalist. And so he'd been surprised, and even a little ashamed, to realize just how strongly his nationality had shaped him. Not just in his actions and his expectations, but in his political convictions, which he would have liked to think had been formed through his powers of reason and his intellect alone. His loathing of the super rich, for example, was on some level not a political stance at all, but merely a very Kiwi expression of disdain. Disdain for those who lived in childish comfort and who delegated labor and, to put it plainly, who simply weren't hardcore enough to do without. Their luxuries had not been earned or exerted for, but had been merely purchased, and that was something any fool could do. Stepping over a fallen tree trunk, he saw, in the ferny undergrowth in front of him, an unsupported chain-link fence, the temporary kind used at music festivals, but here, plainly long untouched. It ran up and down the mountain, the wired sections curving away from him, encircling what seemed like several acres up ahead. Affixed to one of the sections was a lichen-spotted plastic sign that read, "Research in progress. Please keep out." Tony peered through the fence with mild curiosity, but he could see no clues as to what kind of research was being carried out beyond it. Maybe it was something seismological, he thought. The landslide had been triggered by a spate of earthquakes, after all. He diverted his course uphill, keeping the fence on his left, and presently came over a little rise to find what he recognized as a trailer-mounted phone mast, still attached to the truck that had evidently hauled it there. A faint vehicle track led away through the bush and out of sight. A second trailer, a mobile home, was parked behind it. The door of the mobile home was open, and sitting on the step, smoking a cigarette, was a burly man in his 40s, wearing a woolen beanie and a green zipped-up fleece. He saw Tony and stood up at once.
"Kia ora," said Tony.
"Hi there,"
said the man with trepidation. He flicked his cigarette away. There was a little pause, each evidently waiting for the other to speak first. Then Tony nodded at the truck.
"Bit of a job driving that up here."
"Yeah,"
said the man.
"No four-wheel drive, I'm guessing."
"Yeah, not so much."
His accent was either American or Canadian. Tony could never tell the difference, and never asked, in case he got it wrong.
"You must really need the signal," he said.
The man glanced towards the fence.
"I guess somebody does."
"The research there," Tony said after another little pause.
"Is it?"
"Yeah,
geophysics,"
said the man.
"Radiometric survey."
"Oh, right," Tony said.
"What does that involve?"
"Don't ask me," said the man. "I'm just security."
"But like radiation? Like radioactive?"
Tony knew that granite contained radioactive elements. He recalled a chemistry class in high school where he'd set off a Geiger counter by waving it over a chunk of granite, a banana, and a vintage watch with hands that glowed in the dark. And there was plenty of granite around the Kotawai Pass. He'd spent the night beside a giant slab of it. He looked at the fence with new interest. But the man only shrugged.
Like I said.
Huh,
said Tony.
You'd think they would have told you.
Yeah, well,
said the man and shrugged again.
How long have you been over here?
Tony asked, and then added, to be friendly,
for your sins.
Long enough,
said the man.
What about you?
Yeah, just a bit of tramping, Tony said. Trying to shake out the cobwebs.
Right.
At least it's not raining, right?
Yeah,
said the man.
Right.
Tony couldn't think of anything else to say.
Well, have a good one.
You too,
said the man. They exchanged a nod. Tony turned and had just set off again when something caught his eye. On the roof of the mobile phone site, clinging to the base of the lattice signal tower, was a small, slender parakeet. Almost sea green in color, with a yellow crown and a distinctive orange band above its beak. Tony stopped in his tracks. Holy shit, he said, turning back to point the creature out. And then he froze. For in the few seconds that his back had been turned, the man had silently unzipped his fleece, and he was now putting his right hand into his left armpit, as if reaching for a gun. They stared at each other.
Yeah?
The man said without moving. Tony's mind had gone blank. His heart was pounding.
What?
Said the man, still not moving.
Parakeet,
Tony said. He pointed at the bird.
Super endangered. There's only, like, 60 of them left.
The man said nothing. His eyes moved to the bird. It cocked its head, hopped off the signal tower, and ducked out of sight. When it was gone, he looked again at Tony. His hand was still in his armpit. His eyes were narrowed.
Pretty lucky, Tony said. I mean, geez, what are the chances?
The man nodded very slightly, his eyes still narrowed.
Well, see ya,
Tony said and turned away. After a few steps, he looked back and saw that the man had taken out a pack of cigarettes. He shook one out and put it in the corner of his mouth, and then returned the pack to his breast pocket and zipped up his fleece again. He was dipping his face into his lighter as Tony disappeared into the trees. Had he just imagined it? A flash of brown leather inside the guy's fleece, a suggestion of a holster, a certain stiffness to his posture, shoulder blades drawn together, elbows held apart, chest thrust forward, the weight of something solid knocking at his ribs. The harder Tony tried to picture it, the more ludicrous it seemed. After all, he told himself, the biggest predator in Kotawai was probably a ferret. There might be a few deer in the park, or pigs, but there was no rabies in New Zealand, nothing that might make those animals in any way a threat. And Tony had never heard of anybody going hunting with a handgun, let alone one that was concealed. And anyway, what kind of research in the middle of a national park could possibly merit armed security? In a country where even the police only carried guns in special circumstances. Of course he'd only imagined it. He must have done. This was New Zealand, for heaven's sake. People didn't carry guns. He'd just spooked himself. Feeling foolish, Tony quickened his pace and made a studied effort to think of something else, forcing his mind back to the orange-fronted parakeet, and then to one of his school friends growing up, Nick Wiley, who'd had a budgie named Luigi. And then to a summer party at the Wiley's house, playing sardines by torchlight in the garden. And then to the generator torch with a pump handle that he'd loved to play with as a boy, squeezing the beam of light to whirring brightness and then watching it fade as the mechanism wound down under the heel of his hand. He came over a bank of ferns and looked up to see that he'd arrived at a stock wire fence that he guessed must mark the upper boundary of the Darvish property. He'd proceeded along it, stepping as quietly as possible, and peering down through the trees below him. And soon he spied a forlorn-looking windsock at the end of a wide, level terrace that could only be the airstrip. He came to a halt, disappointed the plane wasn't there. It was Saturday, and Tony knew from Shelley's document that a carload of Burnham Wood members had driven down the previous night to spend the weekend working at the farm. The principal planting sites were all near the bottom of the property, in the livestock pens that adjoined the shearing sheds, along the northern fence line, and in some patches of scrub in the paddocks just above the house. They would probably confine themselves to those areas, and the farm was large enough and forested enough to offer plenty of cover if he wanted to explore. But it would be foolish to venture out on a day when their numbers were expanded, Tony thought. And he didn't want to risk being spotted before his investigation had even properly begun. He spent the rest of the day in reconnaissance, traversing the hillside above the fence, scouting on bluffs and boulders, and tramping back up above the tree line to triangulate his position between the ranges and the lake. He found an elevated spot that offered a decent view over the shearing shed, but although he could just make out the faces of the crew using his binoculars, it was hard to tell what exactly they were doing as they moved among the livestock pens, bending and straightening and hauling things in and out of view. And Tony found he got a headache if he stared through the binoculars too long. He camped near the airstrip that night, and on Sunday morning he returned to the track along the ridgeline and built a cairn to mark the turnoff, in case he ever approached from there in a heavy cloud again. When the cairn was built, he ate a cold lunch of apples and cheese in a sheltered spot below the ridge, and washed it down with the last of the water he'd brought with him from the car. He was just considering where the nearest place to refill his water bottles might be, when a light aircraft whined directly overhead. The plane was flying low, clearly coming into land. It banked over the Darvish farm and then dropped out of sight behind the trees. Tony stuffed his water bottle back in his bag and hurried after it. He arrived at the fence about 15 minutes later, panting slightly, to see that the plane had landed, its propellers were still. And the pilot was nowhere to be seen. But Tony was elated, for the registration mark on the tail was clearly legible from where he stood. He took his fountain pen out of his pocket and wrote the letters on the back of his hand. Zulu, Kilo, Charlie, Uniform, Oscar. He murmured aloud with some relish, for he had learned the phonetic alphabet at school, and he always enjoyed having a reason to recall it. He watched the plane for almost an hour without seeing any movement, and briefly considered climbing over the fence to get a closer look. But he was rewarded for his patience when a man in a dark tracksuit finally strolled up the hill and into view. It could only be Lemoyne. At his side was Mira, and they appeared to be in deep conversation. Lemoyne was gesturing around him at the hillside, and Mira was nodding and gesturing as well. After 10 minutes or so, they seemed to reach an agreement, for they shook hands and said goodbye. Mira headed back downhill, and Lemoyne returned to the plane and climbed back into the cockpit, and Tony made a gun out of his index finger and his thumb, aimed it at the billionaire, and pulled the trigger. "Pow," he whispered. The propellers jutted to life. Lemoyne reversed the aircraft in a neat half circle until it was facing south, and then he opened the throttle, roared down the airstrip, and took off. Tony hadn't stayed to see him go. By the time the plane had vanished over the peaks of the Kotawai Ranges, he was on his way back to Thorndyke to refill his water bottles, retrieve his laptop from the boot of Veronica's car, and pursue the first proper lead, he whispered it, of his career. Back in the visitor center car park, he plugged a USB Wi-Fi adapter into his laptop and sat in the passenger seat of Veronica's car, exploring the website of New Zealand's Civil Aviation Authority for almost 2 hours. He had just discovered that the plane Lemoyne was flying, registration mark ZKCUO, was owned by an aero club near Queenstown, when a notification popped up to say that his battery was about to die. The visitor center had now closed, but he could see a chip shop on the highway frontage that appeared to be still open, and he went in to ask if the proprietor would allow him to recharge his laptop behind the counter if he ordered a meal. A fee of $2 was agreed for the use of the power, and Tony had handed over his device and was counting out cash for a burger and a battered hot dog, when the guy said abruptly,
"Plane spotter."
It took Tony a moment to realize that the guy had seen the registration mark written on the back of his hand.
Oh, he said. "No, actually, I'm more interested in the pilot than the plane. Robert Lemoyne?"
The guy made a blank face.
"Billionaire?" said Tony. "American? I'm working on a story about him." "Oh, yeah?"
"Yeah," Tony said, handing over the money.
"Actually, I was going to ask if you'd seen him."
The guy shrugged.
"I wouldn't know. Small seaplane, in and out of the airstrip, up by the pass." "You mean the Taranau place?"
"Darvish, I think,"
But the guy was nodding.
Yeah, he said. Jill Terenow, back in the day. Her dad.
Oh, right, said Tony, remembering the Darvishes had inherited the property.
Yeah. They were going to subdivide.
That's the one.
Couldn't do it, the guy said. Took it off the market. No takers.
No, I thought they sold it, said Tony. Didn't they?
No, mate. Not after the road closed. Couldn't get a price.
Huh, said Tony with interest.
My mistake.
He watched as the guy peeled wax paper from a pre-made burger patty and slapped it on the grill.
So you haven't noticed a plane? Well, there's always planes, said the guy. They're up there all the time, the Aero Club. Well, used to be.
Right, said Tony, not quite following.
Are you a plane spotter yourself then?
No, mate, the guy said again. He put Tony's hot dog into the fry basket and dunked it into the vat, and then added,
He was, though, Jill's old man.
You mean Terenow?
Yeah. The airstrip, search and rescue, there was all him. That's not Darvish. He couldn't care less.
Tony detected a note of bitterness.
He just got a knighthood, didn't he?
Darvish.
The guy snorted.
Such bullshit.
Tony nodded sympathetically.
Reckon he didn't deserve it?
It's just who you know, said the guy. Isn't it? They just hand them out to their mates. Doesn't mean anything. It's all just a load of shit.
You mean he's got mates in government?
Probably.
Tony waited, but the guy didn't elaborate.
You know the wife better then?
Jill,
he said.
Yeah, she's good people.
But he's not?
He's not even from here,
said the guy darkly. Suddenly it seemed to occur to him that Tony wasn't either.
So what?
He said, eyeing Tony up and down.
You're some kind of reporter?
Not yet, said Tony. Next time you see me, ask me again.
The guy seemed satisfied with this answer, for he didn't say anything more. And when Tony's food was ready, he handed it over the counter with a respectful nod. Tony ate while paging through a stack of peeling Women's Day and Women's Weekly magazines, and then ordered a chocolate milkshake for dessert. By the time he'd finished the shake and thrown all of his wrappers in the bin, he had gained expert knowledge of all the celebrity marriages, divorces, and diet fads of 2014, and his laptop was recharged. The guy unplugged it and handed it back across the counter, and Tony was slipping it back into its padded sleeve when another question occurred to him.
By the way, he said, do you know anything about a research site up near the pass? Above the landslide? A radiometric survey?
Don't think so, said the guy. What's that?
Doesn't matter, Tony said. Thanks for the food.
Searching the name Terenow, along with Airstrip and Thorndike, yielded a small cluster of results, all several years old. They confirmed what the chip shop guy told him. Nigel Terenow, Jill's father, had created the airstrip on his property for the benefit of the local aero club, and on occasion search and rescue had used it as a training ground. Terenow himself had been a search and rescue volunteer. He had died from a stroke at the age of 79, a little over 5 years ago. And it seemed that after his daughter and her husband had inherited the farm, the relationship with the aero club had mostly ceased. As far as Tony could discover, the aircraft ZK-CUO was the only plane to have used the strip since Terenow's death. Open source flight logs showed that it had landed more than a dozen times over the past few months alone. It was getting late, and his battery was running low again. He put away his laptop and drove the short distance to the Department of Conservation campsite by the lake, wondering as he shook out his bivy bag whether it would be worth investing in a solar-powered portable generator if he could find such a thing available for sale. Mira would have laughed at the idea, he thought. She would have immediately gone scouting around the garages and back patios of Thorndike, and would have come back triumphant, armed with a list of addresses with unattended outdoor charge points meant for fairy lights and lawnmowers and power washers, or a list of names of all the soft-hearted locals she'd won over, who were willing to exchange the use of a power strip for an hour or so of light domestic chores. Keep your money, she would have said, affecting a lordly magnanimity.
Put away your little coins. I give you electricity for free.
But that was the old mirror, Tony thought with bitterness as he climbed into his sleeping bag. God only knew what the new mirror, the fully funded, value-maximizing, if-you-can't-beat-em-join-em-mirror would do. He woke on Monday morning to find an email waiting in his inbox. It was the title certificate for 1606 Kodawai Pass Road that he'd requested, and he opened the attachment to discover that the title was held by Jill and Owen Darvish, as it had been since May 2012, and that although permission had been sought to subdivide, no material changes to the property had yet been carried out. Tony sat up in his sleeping bag, frowning. At the hui, Mira said explicitly that Lemoyne had bought the farm. He must have done. He'd paid her $10,000 already. Why would he pay her to come and cultivate a patch of land he didn't own? And what about the bunker? Mira had definitely said that he was putting in a bunker. What kind of survivalist would build a bunker on property that belonged to someone else? That would defeat the whole purpose, surely. Tony reread the title certificate a second time, feeling a rising annoyance. For if the land hadn't legally changed hands, then he had no story. Or rather, he did have a story, only it was one where a foreign billionaire had donated $10,000 to an activist, not-for-profit, avowedly left-wing enterprise at no obvious benefit to himself. And Tony would rather drink his own urine than write that. He decided to email Owen Darvish directly. Perhaps there was a perfectly logical explanation he was missing. And in any case, it was good journalistic practice to give all parties a chance to explain themselves up front. Eyeing the 7% battery level remaining on his laptop, he found an email address on the Darvish Pest Control website and tapped out a brief inquiry. He sent it off, and then went for a freezing dip in the lake before getting dressed and making breakfast on his butane stove. He ate slowly, enjoying the view, and had just turned on his phone to begin searching for the nearest hardware store that might sell solar-powered portable generators, when it started ringing, making him jump. He picked up.
"Hello? Anthony? Owen Darvish," said a loud, thickly accented voice in his ear. "Oh, wow. Hello," Tony said, scrambling to his feet and fishing in his pocket for the car keys. "Thanks for getting back to me so quickly." "Just responding to your email," Sir Owen said. "Just a quick courtesy callback. You said you were writing an article." "Yeah, hang on. Just let me get my—"
He slid into the car and scrabbled around to find his dictaphone.
"Yeah, I'm writing a piece about Robert Lemoyne."
He put his phone on speaker and clicked record.
"And what is it that you want from me exactly?"
"Well," said Tony, deciding to go all in,
"I guess I wanted to ask you if you sold him your property in Thorndyke."
There was a little silence. Then Sir Owen said,
"Anthony, I'm sure you know already that my company's in business with Autonomo. It's an ongoing relationship, and I'm not going to compromise it by talking to the press. He paid you a sum of $10 million for the land, is that right?"
Tony had no idea if this was a plausible figure. He was hoping that Darvish would correct him. But Sir Owen only said,
"I'm not sure what you're trying to achieve here, mate."
"I'm just trying to get my head around it,"
Tony said, feeling a spike of excitement. For if he'd been on the wrong track altogether, then Sir Owen would surely have denied it out of hand.
"So you do confirm the sale has taken place?"
"No, I don't confirm it. I'm not confirming anything."
"Could you tell me why not?"
"Look, before we go any further, Anthony, I want to know who you've been talking to, if that's all right. Where have you got this from?"
"I can't reveal my sources, I'm afraid," Tony said.
"Then I'm not interested in giving any interviews. Sorry."
"You gave some interviews quite recently," Tony said quickly, before Sir Owen could hang up. "And I noticed that you never mentioned Robert Lemoyne by name in any of them. Could you tell me why that was? Sorry if that's a silly question. It's just that in my line of work, it's easy sometimes to mistake an innocent omission for a cover-up."
Another little silence. Tony realized he was holding his breath, hardly daring to believe his own audacity. Then Sir Owen said, more carefully,
"Whereabouts are you based, Anthony?"
"Actually, right now I'm in Thorndyke," Tony said.
"Is that right?"
Sir Owen said.
"Nice place," Tony said.
"I got a good view over your farm from up on the ridge there. Amazing position. Worth what he paid you for sure."
Sir Owen expelled a breath.
"You've got it wrong, mate."
"So help me get it right," Tony said. What's your arrangement with Robert Lemoyne?
Anthony, you're talking about a business relationship. I'm not prepared to...
So there is a relationship. You know each other personally.
I'm not prepared to comment on that.
When did you first meet? Can you tell me that much?
I'm afraid not, Sir Owen said.
Well, maybe I can jog your memory a bit, Tony said. I've been looking at the flight log of a plane that's made quite a few trips to Thorndyke recently. Registration mark Zulu, Kilo, Charlie, Uniform, Oscar. Does that ring any bells?
Look, Anthony, Sir Owen said firmly, you emailed me, and I'm doing you the courtesy of giving you a call back like you asked, but I'm not interested in talking to the press, all right? Good luck with you.
Just one more question, Tony said quickly, before he could hang up. Mr. Darvish.
Sir Owen made an irritated noise.
I've got nothing to tell you, Anthony. You're wasting your time.
It's about something else, actually, Tony said,
choosing a subject almost at random. All he wanted was to keep Owen Darvish on the line.
It's about, a radiometric survey project. As I said, I was up in the...
We're not involved with radiometrics,
Sir Owen interrupted impatiently.
We're just pest control. That's a whole separate technology. Different kind of drone.
What?
Said Tony.
Did you say drone?
Sir Owen made an irritated noise again.
Sorry, Anthony, he said. You'll have to talk to someone at Autonomo. That's nothing to do with us.
Autonomo? Said Tony. Wait, what do you mean a different kind of drone?
There was a certain kind of man who couldn't resist giving a scientific explanation when asked. Owen Darvish, it seemed, was one.
It's called an airborne magnetic and radiometric survey, he said,
still terse.
And they do it from way, way up, thousands of meters up. High-flying aircraft, geophysical mapping, totally different to our project. Different technology, different drone, different everything.
I'm sorry, Tony said. I'm not quite following.
Radiometric survey, Sir Owen repeated. That's what you said.
No, Tony said. I meant the research site in Kodawai National Park, above the landslide.
The line went quiet. Then Sir Owen said,
What?
The radiometric survey site, up near the pass, above the landslide.
I think we've got our wires crossed somewhere here,
Sir Owen said.
I spoke to a security guard, Tony said. He said it was something involving radiometric...
Security guard where?
In the national park, Tony said. Right behind your fence.
Sorry, mate, you're not making any sense.
There was a mobile phone tower and a security guard and a fence around...
Sorry, mate, sorry.
You mentioned Autonomo, Tony began.
But Sir Owen said loudly,
Thanks anyway.
And before Tony could say anything else, he'd hung up. Tony clicked off his dictaphone and sat in the front seat frowning and staring out through the windscreen at the cloudy surface of the lake. His phone buzzed in his hand, startling him, and he looked down to see that he'd received a text message. It was from Rosie, and she wanted to know if he was winning.
Well, I just had my first no comment, he texted back. So I guess that means I'm onto something.
Definitely, she replied. And Tony was plunged instantly into doubt. Was it really that suspicious? Yes, Darvish had refused to talk to him. So what? He had no obligation to the media. He hadn't taken any oaths of office. He hadn't been deposed. He was a private citizen. His affairs were none of Tony's business. He had refused to confirm that he had sold Lemoyne's property because he hadn't sold Lemoyne's property. Tony knew that for a fact. He had the title deed right here. Fine. Lemoyne had told Mira something different. But maybe he was putting in the bunker on a lease. Or maybe he and Darvish had a gentleman's agreement. Or maybe a sale was in the offing, but they were still negotiating terms. In which case, Darvish would have no reason whatsoever to want to answer any questions, least of all from a nobody like Tony, a wannabe investigative journalist, a let's-pretend reporter, a trust fund dilettante who was basically unpublished, and so inexperienced he could hardly even call himself a hack.
Jesus Christ, Tony, he said aloud. Pull your head in.
His phone lit up again. Rosie had sent two emojis, a gun followed by a cigarette. Then she wrote, Oh, wait, and sent them again the other way, first the cigarette, and then the gun. Smoking gun, she wrote in explanation. Because I really hope you find one.
Tony didn't smile. Funny you should say that, he typed, his expression grim, thinking back to his encounter with the guard on Saturday morning. But then he felt stupid and deleted it. I might be out of range for a few days, just FYI, he wrote instead, following a hunch. He looked at the message for a few seconds, making up his mind, before hitting send. Amazing, she wrote again, and then mysterious, and then be careful. Tony's thumb hovered over the keypad. Rosie didn't know about the offer that Lemoyne had made to Burnham Wood. He told her only that he was investigating super-rich survivalists, having been unwilling, little though it mattered, to mention Mira's name. But he didn't want to think about Mira right now. And so it was partly out of guilt and bitterness, and partly out of wishful thinking, and partly just to end the conversation, that he responded, XXX.